Welcome back. I'm Hanat Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This summer, Emily White, an intern for NPR's All Songs Considered, wrote a blog post about music in the digital age in which she admitted that she had over 11,000 songs in her iTunes library, but had only bought 15 albums in her entire life. Her comments caused quite a stir online and sparked an interesting discussion about music consumption in today's world. Should Emily White be vilified for her love of music, but her lack of financial support for the musicians she loves? Online streaming and subscription services like Pandora and Spotify have gained millions of listeners in the last few years. They've just begun to release data on how much artists are paid for their music. Are these services just a newer version of large corporate record companies, or are they replacing the kind of illegal downloading that became rampant in the late 90s? And how do musicians get by in today's music economy? And we want to hear from you, the listeners. How do you get your music today? How do you listen to your music? How do you support the musicians you love? And is that important to you while you listen to their music? And basically, when was the last time you stepped into a record store also? Joining us today to discuss this is Greg Kot. He's been the musician critic at the Chicago Tribune for over 20 years. He also co-hosts Sound Opinions on NPR, quote, the world's only rock and roll talk show. And he's written several books, including Ripped, How the Wired Generation Revolutionized Music. He joins us by phone in Chicago. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Hannah. How are you?
Good. Thank you for being with us. And with us also is Zoe Keating, a critically acclaimed musician, a one-woman orchestra. She uses a cello and a foot-controlled laptop to create compelling music. She's known for both her use of technology and her DIY ethic that's resulted in the sale of over 45,000 copies of her self-released albums. In addition, she was named a Young Global Leader by the World Economic Forum and serves on the boards of the San Francisco chapter of the Recording Academy, the Magic Orchestra, and Cash Music, a nonprofit that builds open source digital tools for musicians and labels. And she joins us by phone as well. Hi, Zoe.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And Brian Zisk specializes in digital media, web broadcasting, and distribution technologies. He produces the SF Music Tech Summit. The next one, by the way, is on February 19th, and the Future of Money and Technology Summit. He's also co-founder of the San Francisco Music Tech Fund and co-founder and technologies director of the Future of Music Coalition. He joins us by phone from San Rafael. Hey, Brian.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. And just a note to our listeners, we did reach out to Pandora in the hopes of having them on our show, and they did get back to us, but they told us that their founder, Tim Westergren, would be the best person to speak on the issue, but he wasn't available during this hour. So just for the record there. So we would like to take your calls at 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255 with your experiences, how you download music, how you support the musicians you listen to. And you can also send us an email with that information at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Brian, let me start with you. For our listeners that haven't used these services, can you give us a brief explanation of Pandora and Spotify and how they're different?
Sure. Well, I mean, anyone who hasn't used these services definitely should. There are a lot of complicated rights around music. So let's start with Pandora. Due to certain legal structures, they are allowed to broadcast over the Internet, similar to a terrestrial radio station, and pay fees to both the songwriters, the publishers, and the performers, but they are able to do so without having to get permission for each individual piece of music. So you listen to it, you hear a stream of music. It may be around an artist, but it's limited in what can be played. And I like it personally because you kind of click play and get a great stream of music. Spotify is much more complicated. And because they're more complicated, they weren't able to get the automatic approval to stream everything. You can go and say, I want to hear this particular song by this particular artist. Because they went and negotiated everything so directly, and because there is, a higher royalty rate involved, there are more things you can do. Now, the big question is, are you one of these people who really likes to program your music experience, hunting and pecking and choosing the optimal thing for that moment, in which case you may prefer Spotify? Or are you somebody who would rather kind of turn on the radio and hear great music all day? Then you very well may prefer Pandora.
So those are two very different experiences. And so how then do each of them deal with record labels?
So, and this is actually a very complicated situation. And what happens is that Pandora doesn't actually deal with the record labels. They are able to, through the statutory webcast license, which puts lots of restrictions on them, play any music they want. And then instead of paying the record labels, who usually don't pay the artist, they pay an organization called Sound Exchange, who, while there are a lot of issues with them, do generally pay most of their artists. So Pandora doesn't actually have to deal with the record labels at all. Now, Spotify, on the other hand, and let me frame this a little bit, then it's not just Pandora and Spotify. It's Pandora, Spotify, hundreds or thousands of not as successful services, as well as other folks who would like to be streaming the music. Now, because Spotify lets you play an individual song whenever you want, what they've licensed, they have to get those rights from the record company. So they went and negotiated a deal with all of the major record companies. Now, it's not quite that clear because it's very hard to negotiate a deal with the record companies. So Spotify gave a bunch of equity ownership in the company to each of these record labels. Then the rates, which are not public and unknown, were set, but I can't believe that the record labels didn't cut them a substantial break for giving them ownership in the company. So basically, that's it. Mm-hmm. Spotify got the rights by cozying up and doing the deals and giving them part ownership, and Pandora operates legally under the statutory webcast license and does not need to even deal with the record label.
And which of those models is more beneficial to the artist at the end of the day?
Well, they're both beneficial. I mean, what's more beneficial, an 8-track tape or a cassette? I know that's old stuff. They're both beneficial. It's like when, the Future of Music Coalition recently did a study and came up with 42 separate revenue streams for artists. So it's kind of like your family. It's like, do I make money? Yes. Does my wife make money? Yes. Do my kids? Yeah, it's like, it's not which is superior. It's how do they all fit together into an ecosystem that can support the creators of the music, mm-hmm. as well as the fans who enjoy the music.
Right. Pandora recently released some of the payment information that it makes to artists, mm-hmm. and it touted the fact that huge musicians like Drake and Lil Wayne receive right. $3 million in royalties. And, that sounds great, but, it seems like most artists aren't getting millions of plays on these sites. If I can go to Greg Kot, does this look like a sustainable model going forward for the non-Billboard Top 40 artists?
Well, it's, we've been 10 years into the post-Napster era, if you will, when this whole brave new future of the music world unfolded. The 20th century music industry basically went, kaput overnight. Revenue is down more than 50% from where it was in 1999, 2000 to where it is now. And, the promise was that artists were going to have this, a more equitable future. That the artists who were less than the haves, the upper crust 5% that dominated the music industry in the 20th century, the other artists were going to have a real chance to get exposure and to have a real chance at making, say, a modest middle class living, which really wasn't possible under the old scheme. But we're 10 years into this world now, and it's becoming increasingly apparent that you know, the brave new future, you know, it may be here, but in terms of the actual effect that it has had on the economic status of a lot of artists, I'm not so sure that it's had much of an impact. You know, you saw those numbers that Pandora released, and, you know, you're talking about a few thousand artists that are doing pretty well. Some are doing extraordinarily well, but they're the usual suspects, the Jay-Z's and the Lil Wayne's, as you mentioned, Coldplay, people like that. You know, the vast majority of artists who are on these streaming services are not seeing a great deal of income from them. And the promise is always that, you know, eventually it's going to be all these little revenue streams accumulating and adding up, and eventually you'll be able to cobble together some kind of a living off of it. But the reality is that it really hasn't, you know, turned into this any sort of a real economic boon for these artists. So it's been a struggle, and I think right now artists are at a point where they're starting to say, you know, well, when is the future going to arrive? Because the new boss seems an awful lot like the old boss. We've got a new set of middlemen. You know, instead of Sony and Clear Channel, we've got, you know, Pandora and iTunes and YouTube. But are we really any better off than we were 10 or 12 years ago? I would argue that they are, because they have much more access to their fans than they did 10, 12 years ago. But in terms of the economic reality, the day-to-day ability to pay their rent, to put a meal on their table, I'm not so sure that's improved.
And speaking of the economic reality of artists, Zoe, let's go to you. You recently released your earnings from your music from the past year, including money you earned from iTunes and Amazon. Can you talk a little bit about that breakdown? And was there anything, you know, surprising to you about how much money you got from these various sources?
You know, it is true that there are so many different sources, but they're not all equal. So for 2011, I put my numbers forward, and my total music sales were 43% of my income. So that's, you know, a mixture of iTunes and Bandcamp, which is a service I use to sell directly to fans, and Amazon, what have you. So that's 43% of my income is just music sales. And then something like Sound Exchange royalties, which is 90% of my Sound Exchange is Pandora.
What are Sound Exchange royalties?
That's the money that you know, Pandora gets has a compulsory license to, you know, to play music. That's what Brian was talking about, and it pays performance royalties to Sound Exchange. And since I own both the my copyrights and I'm the performer, I get both halves.
And you're the record company, right? There's no record company.
Yeah, I'm the record company, and so Pandora passes that money through Sound Exchange, and Sound Exchange passes it over to me after taking a small amount for administrative fees and a little bit that goes to the AFM, the American Federation of Musicians. So my Sound Exchange for 2011 was 0.52% of my income.
So why don't you speak to what Greg was just talking about in terms of making a living and just living as a musician that's not on the Billboard Top 40?
Yeah.
Is it working out?
It is actually working out really well. My career has only existed in this internet world. It's sort of, I put my first album out really in the last month of 2005. So my career has moved along with both social media and the world of piracy. And I don't even call it piracy. I call it file sharing. Like, I think it's kind of necessary for me to solve my obscurity problem. That's the biggest problem that artists like me face, is that we're obscure. And so I use all these, I think of Pandora as my friend, and then I'm pretty sure that a lot of listeners find me there. You know, I give away a lot of music. I try to make my music as accessible as possible, since no one's ever going to find it in the store. And then a lot of my effort, I don't do any marketing, but I do try to educate listeners, to let them know that I'm a self-supported artist. There's no middlemen other than these services in between me and the listener. So the best way to support me is to buy something from me.
And so you said you were okay with, well, not okay, but you said we shouldn't call it pirating, we should call it file sharing, and that it helps artists who may be like you?
Yeah.
And
I try
kind of that direct relationship with the listener.
Yeah.
No matter how they got your music. Sorry.
Yeah, I try to focus my efforts on education so that there's always going to be some, I think, small percentage of consumers who are actually going to buy something, who are going to buy music. A lot of them are going to get it for free. And for those people who are going to buy music, I want to let them know the best way to do that. So I do hear, I wish I had a little more data on this, but I do hear anecdotally that, you know, a lot of people, you know, they torrented my albums and then they get to know me through my social media presence. They get to know me as an individual, and then they go and pay $50 for the album.
So you are dealing with the system as it is. You're not out to change anything. You're kind of benefiting from the system as it is and saying, wait a minute, this is how it is.
There are things about it that I would like to change, in that artists like me are, you know, at the bottom of the food chain. I don't have any power to negotiate my rates with Spotify. I have to go through an aggregator to get my music in there, and I know that I probably get the least of any of those players. So there's things like that, but also I really think that data has been left out of this this equation. And the thing that I would like to know is that, you know, for say just the first two quarters of 2012, where I had 1.5 million listens on Pandora, and for that I received $1,600 in royalties, which was nice. But really, that, you know, that's a small percentage of my income, and I would rather know about those listeners. I want to know how to reach them. How many of those listeners had Zoe Keating radio stations? How many of them gave a thumbs up to one of my songs, which is something you do in Pandora? You can go and give a thumbs up. Oh, I like that. So it'll play something like that more often. I want to know how I can let those listeners know that I have a concert near them next month, because I make my living touring and selling music. And how do I reach them? And I think that this has really been left out, and I feel this is where I feel that artists really need to, I don't know, come together. We need to just work with these music companies to try to get some of these things in here, to stop it being this kind of false dichotomy of like the artist versus the company. I really think we could work together to make something that works for all of us, and that the companies want our music and the musicians want to reach their fans. And right now I think there's a little bit of a gap there, and that needs to be worked on.
And let me just give out the phone number to our listeners. If you'd like to chime in, ask a question to our guests, or if you'd like to share your experience with digital music, we promise we won't tell anybody. Just everybody who's listening, 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Tell us how you get your music, and how do you feel about supporting that artist that you're listening to, especially if you're supporting local Bay Area artists. You go to their shows. Do you listen to them on Pandora and Spotify? Also, are you a subscriber to those services versus just listening to them and kind of enduring the ads that come on? 866-798-8255. Or you can shoot us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's talk about some of the legal aspects of this. Pandora, which has, by the way, 60 million listeners, introduced a bill into Congress recently. Is lobbying for a bill that was introduced recently, and they're calling it the Internet Radio Fairness Act. And it would basically lower the royalty rates that streaming companies pay to match those of satellite radio providers, which are lower than companies like Pandora. Brian, how would this change the game? What would this change? Hello, Brian?
Can you hear me?
Yes. Hello. Welcome back.
Hi. Sorry. So it's interesting because, you know, I used to be a webcaster, and when we were lucky enough to sell the company before rates had even been set, we always wanted to get back into it. But the rates now are so high that it was kind of like really interesting that Pandora was able to make a go of it. And my belief is that if their rates were more equitable, that there would be a lot more entrants. And it's really interesting how this is framed, because when the law got passed, and it was a really good law that allowed us to start webcasting when you were allowed to do it without getting permission from all of the labels, because if you needed to get permission from all of the labels, nothing would have ever happened. So what Pandora is now saying, they're not saying we need to pay substantially lower rates. What they're saying, and it's really kind of a technical argument, is as of now, rates are set on a willing buyer, willing seller standard. And it's been clear to everybody that the major labels who control the music refuse to sell it unless they can get an absurdly high rate. So what Pandora is saying is not that we need to pay nothing like all of the broadcasters who, you know, if they were paying what Pandora was paying, would pay billions of dollars a year. But what they're saying is as we move into this digital world, there are similar services. And these other services, the satellite folks who pay 7.5%, the cable folks who pay 15%, and then you've got Pandora who's paying over 50%, the rates are set by different standards. And what Pandora is saying is we want to have one standard instead of willing buyer, willing seller, where the labels can drive the rates up by saying, well, we would refuse to sell it except for a very high fee. They're actually trying to change it to the same standard as satellite and cable. And while I'm not going to go in depth through what the four standards are there, it's basically to maximize the availability of creative works to the public, to afford the copyright holder a fair income for his or her creative work, to reflect the relative roles of the copyright owner, the copyright user, with respect to relative creative contribution, blah, 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 and to minimize any disruptive impact on the structure of the industries involved. So what they're saying is not, hey, we're paying, you know, way too much, and it was a fair rate in the past, and we just want to, you know, pay a lower rate. What they're trying to do is make it so that all of the different broadcasters, at least online, are on an equal footing. And then really the big elephant in the room goes back to if, you know, commercial broadcast radio stations should be paying a royalty to, you know, the performers of the song. And if I had to look at Pandora and say, hey, you could have done something slightly better, is if they had really tried to get to bring the rate together for all of these things, then there could be, right now there's an argument. If you lower, if you put Pandora on this other standard, will there be more money for artists or less money? And it's hard to say, because if there's a lower rate and it's a more sustainable business, you'll have more entrants, more people doing it. Will it be more overall or less overall? No one really knows. But what is clear is that if commercial broadcast radio had to pay a rate, not even a Pandora rate, even the lowest 7.5% rate, you would be talking about extra billions of dollars going to the artists in the right hole.
And, Brian, you remind me of the days when I used to stick an empty tape into the radio and just record. And that was my music, and that's how I got my music back in the day. I was wondering, how, if like a song plays on the radio, how does the artist get his money? Is it every time the song plays, he gets something?
So, and this is something that's
complicated.
Really, no. Do you want to take it, Zoe?
Yeah, Greg, go ahead. Oh, Zoe? Who's that?
I was just saying,
yeah,
you know, the system is not fair. It doesn't make any sense that if you're in a car and you listen to a song on your iPod through your sound system in your car and it's streaming off of Pandora, say you play the same song, it's a totally different rate and it's calculated entirely differently and it goes through different entities, whether it's coming off the internet or it's coming from a satellite or if it's coming over FM. It's like right now, radio does not operate on a census model, meaning that it doesn't say like, okay, I played the song, and now I'm going to track it.
Okay.
Radio is sampled. So there's like, you know, some small sample period over during the year that might be a period of a few days. And if whatever artists show up during that sample period are the ones whom some royalty is paid. And that royalty
I'm going to have to stop you right there. Sorry, Zoe.
Yeah.
We are up on a break. So much to talk about. We will be right back. This is Your Call. I'm Hana Baba, and we'll be back right after the break.
Every Tuesday, the Your Call team sends out their weekly email newsletter that keeps folks up on what's coming up on the show. Gives you resources to let you learn more and to get involved. You can subscribe today, and then you'll know what's coming up and can submit your questions and comments before the show even goes to air. It's free and easy to sign up. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. You can also participate in today's show by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or send an email, question, or comment to feedback at yourcallradio.org.
I'm Hannah Baba, and you're listening to Your Call. For those of you joining us now, we are talking about music, and we're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Today, we're having a conversation about the modern music economy. How do you listen to music in this digital age? How do you support the music and the musicians that you love? Join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have a number of callers, so let's go straight to the phone lines and talk to James from Jacksonville, Florida. Thanks, James, for calling in.
Thanks for taking my call. I kind of grew up in the piracy age, like when I started getting into high school, Napster was the big thing. And for a long time, I just pirated music and didn't care about it. But as I became an audiophile, I started buying records and I started buying CDs, and now I have somewhere around the lines of 1,000 vinyl records of bands. And every time I'm at a concert, if they have vinyl records, I'll buy pretty much everything they have on the merchandise table if I really like them. And I've really grown into someone who likes to support the band as much as I can by going to shows and buying physical media. And I still pirate, though, because I know eventually I'm going to support the artist in one way or the other. In fact, earlier my roommate and I were having this discussion because he was telling me to start using Spotify, which I had used Spotify in the past, but I stopped because at the time it was premium only and I didn't have the money to pay for it, but now it's free service, so I was going to start using it again.
Okay, thanks so much. Greg, vinyl records are kind of making a comeback, and many new releases are accompanied by a free digital download. So is this still a relevant source of revenue for the artists?
Well, the artists that I talk to, especially the ones who are kind of operating on a shoestring level, say that vinyl is a huge source for them. It's one way to sustain them. I mean, we're talking about something as basic as getting from one town to the next, and they're able to sell a few albums merch table at a show. That enables them to you know, get enough gas money to get the van to the next tour stop. So it's that kind of an essential. It's a rare good, as they say. It's not, you know, a vinyl album isn't widely available. You can't just walk into a store anymore and pick up vinyl. You may be able to order it from someplace online, but a lot of times the most convenient spot for a true hardcore fan is to go to the band show and then buy the vinyl afterward as sort of like a parting gift, a little souvenir from that gig. And I've talked to a lot of bands that, you know, have used it to sort of sustain themselves. It is the one physical product in the recording industry of the last decade. It has actually seen a significant growth in the last 10 years, whereas CD sales are plunging to the point where people are saying in 5 to 10 years they won't matter anymore. Vinyl continues to be a very small, but for, as I said, for a lot of these artists, a very significant source of income for a physical product.
So let's thank you for that call, James. And let's go to San Rafael and talk to Bill. Hey, Bill.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Great show. I'm glad you're doing this. I just wanted to add to the discussion the aspect of live music support, because I certainly use all those services, but you know, I've also find out about bands through Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and SoundCloud, YouTube, and personally. I host a bunch of house concerts and small local concerts to support directly independent artists. I modeled this after seeing some concerts by my friend Casey Turner, and Live Local Music Vibe is another local organization. But all of these are ways that I think we locally can support directly, you know, our independent artists. And I think Zoe's been done a great job of you know, sort of putting that information out there and communicating with her fans and communicating with those of us who want to directly support people. Brian certainly has runs a great technology summit every couple times a year. So that's been helpful for me as well. And Greg, I certainly have learned a lot of, you know, new music through him. So I'm just, from a listener side, personally glad that there are so many options to find out about new music.
Thank you, Bill, for the call. Let's go to another call. There are so many calls on the line. Let's go to Anna in San Francisco. Hey, Anna.
Hi, how are you? I wanted to say I'm a huge fan. He found out about her NPR. I heard her interview from NPR, where I get a lot of new music information on your music segment.
You're a fan of Zoe. There was a little break off there.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan. So I've got her concerts, and I get her newsletter, and I have her on my Facebook, and I advocate for her. But my question to Zoe might be is, what can a loving fan like myself do to promote your music? Because, you know, and I'm the huge user of Twitter and of those things, but I do use Facebook. Okay. What can I do?
Thank you, Anna. Thank you for the call. Zoe, why don't you answer your fan?
Well, thank you for calling, and thank you for being a listener. I'm always really grateful for listeners. And actually, NPR has been a huge source of exposure for me. But I think the biggest thing you could do is give my music to your friends. I think that word of mouth is by far the best way for artists like me to spread the word and to be heard. And that's, you know, if you want to give a CD to a friend, or even just point them to a place where they could listen to it for free, I think that's the best thing to do, is just to spread the word one by one. So thank you.
And of course, we here at KLW love Zoe. She is a friend of the station. So thanks for that, Zoe. Okay, let's go to another caller. Chicago, many non-Bay Area people today. Cool. John, hi.
Hey, hi there. Yeah, the internet still works. So I don't feel that far away being in Chicago, but it's good to be a part of the program. I have a couple questions. And Zoe just mentioned, as far as supporting you know, people by stirring people to basically expose the talents of a music artist. I was curious, a couple questions I have is, one is, does anybody have any thoughts or support of a freemium model? And what type of other type of revenue models might go into helping support an artist to do that? And the second question I have is, are there royalties paid on music videos that are viewed online, or even music that's played live that people see online through a video source?
Thanks for the call. Greg, what other avenues are there that artists and listeners should be exploring?
Besides streaming, you know, everybody says that's the future. You know, it's going to be any music you want, anytime, anywhere, and that's that whole idea of the storage locker in the sky is really, you know, the primary source. But I still think that there's going to be a market for physical goods, a small one, but a still significant one. You know, we talk about vinyl. I think there's a basic need for people to have ownership of something physical. You know, an album is not only a great, potentially great piece of music, but also a great piece of affordable artwork that somebody can display in their home as an example of who they are. I mean, the other ways, I mean, I still think the one intellectual, you know, the one area of intellectual property that can't really be digitized in any way that's useful to most people is the live performance. And I think, you know, when it comes right back down to it, it's still about the troubadour going from town to town with the lute slung over his or her back, playing for people in the public square. I don't think that's ever going to go away. And I think the best way for people to show support for an artist is to go out and see the show, and then perhaps buy something at the merch table afterward that they can only get at that one place. I think the idea of the scarce good, the something that is valuable because it is so rare, is a way for an artist to build a small but significant fan base that can help them sustain a living. So, you know, it's kind of an old school model adapting to new school times. You can use the internet. You can use your ability to text people and to email them and to create a buzz over the web about an upcoming appearance. But then it comes down to having a quality act, having quality music that people are going to want to go see live, and then come back and tell 10 other people about it because they were so blown away by that experience, and bring 10 more people to your next show. It really comes down to being able to deliver on both ends, being savvy about the way you're marketing yourself, using the internet that way, but then at the same time being able to deliver a great show and a great live experience that people are going to want to see more than once.
And did you have an answer for John in regards to the music videos and how their royalties are calculated?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that question.
Right, he was wondering how royalties are assessed from music videos, and if they were any different than...
Brian probably would be able to speak better on that than I would.
Sure, go ahead, Brian.
Sure, so it's a little digression from what I wanted to get into, which was all the direct-to-fan, but let's talk about videos for a second. There are two ways in which videos can be online. It can either be licensed or they can be unlicensed. If somebody makes a deal with a record company to put their videos up, there is a payment made to the record companies who then are supposed to pay some money back to the artist. In the case of YouTube, which is what a lot of people are really referring to when they're talking about videos online, if someone puts a video of an artist up there, they can put a video of Zoe up there. If Zoe finds it, she has a couple of options. She could just say, it's great someone put my video up there. She could say, I own the rights to this video, take it down. Or she could say, it's great someone put it up there, but run ads against it, and then YouTube splits the revenue with the copyright owner, whether it's directly to an artist like Zoe or if it's to a label. But the one thing I did want to get at, and it's not really that much money, though if you are one of these people who gets 800 million views, like I think Cy just did, it's a substantial amount of money. But what the internet has really enabled are better ways for the fan and the artist to connect. So Greg talks about the troubadour going town to town. And one of the beautiful things about the internet is you don't actually have to go anywhere to go town to town. There are so many of these, live webcasting companies, folks like, Stage It, where basically you sign up and say, I want to charge people $5 to come and watch this video. Got others like, plenty of others like going into clubs, like Showgoer.tv I'm involved in. There are so many ways to connect directly. You had asked previously the difference between Sony, Clear Channel, and what you've got now. Now you don't need a Sony or a Clear Channel to connect directly with your artist.
You know, Brian, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to cut you off. We're having problems with your line. So let's try to fix that line and then come back to you. We did have a caller earlier, Ted from Berkeley, who was saying, you know what, for me, I want to have something in my hand, a CD, an LP, something personally that I hold in my hand to be able to listen to music. And Zoe, you were talking earlier that you were saying that your whole experience has been online and that it was kind of entirely online. And I'm wondering, are the days of, record stores and just going to a Rasputin, going to an Amoeba, going to dig for that record, are those behind us? Are those over?
I don't think so. I don't think that people who love music are ever going to go away. the experience of them discovering someone like me might, a listener, their experience might be online, but they might go online to get the object. For people who care about objects, they can still, go online and find me and get the object from me. And then for people who don't care about objects, they can just get it from iTunes or
you know, from Bandcamp or Spotify, whatever.
Or if you download it from the internet and put it on a CD, there's an object.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's just, you know, I like to give people whatever is their preferred delivery method. And actually, next year I'm going to re-release all of my albums on vinyl because I get so many requests, and that's something I hadn't done. I actually had, I did things backwards, maybe, but I did performances as my loss leader, in that I didn't initially make money from performing, and I used performances as my marketing tool, and as a way to sell digital or physical music. And I didn't like to sell stuff. I was trying not to sell stuff because I didn't want to clutter up the world.
The merch.
Yeah, and just I don't wear T-shirts, so, but. You know, I realize that I'm just leaving money on the table, and that I have a child, I have a family to support. So I do sell more merchandise now, and then next year I intend to start selling vinyl, just because there are people who really care about music who actually like that format, for sonic reasons. So.
Okay, so let's go to another caller. Let's talk to Jane in Mill Valley. Hi, Jane.
Hey there.
Hey.
First of all, big fan of Sound Opinion, so Greg, I'm thrilled to be on the line with you.
Well, thank you.
I'm a huge college radio fan. In fact, I miss USF station big time, but currently listening to KXP and KTRW and Fordham station in New York. And that's really where I get all my alternative music from. Then go to Pandora, create a station, and go ahead and give a listen. And then Facebook it, and then follow them and do whatever I can to support them. In addition, Kickstarter has been amazing for a lot of independent artists. In fact, I went to a party in Berkeley a couple weeks ago where Lisa Donnelly was playing, and she was able to reach her pledge goal through, I believe, Pledge Music. And that was really successful for her. So kudos to all those people working so hard to get their music heard.
Hey, Jane, one last question. Are you a subscriber to Pandora, or do you just listen to the radio and endure the commercials?
I endure the ads.
Okay. Okay, got it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, take care.
See, that's an interesting point, I find, the subscribers versus the people who just listen. I am one of those people. So what is the difference between the two, Greg, in terms of the effect for the artist? Is there any difference?
You mean between the
between the person kind of listening and enduring the ads versus subscribing and paying the money?
Well, I think, you know, obviously the subscriber functionality is you know, the idea would be that some of that money would eventually trickle down to the artist as well. But I think the real beneficiary of that is Pandora. They want to entice you, to fork over that subscription fee so that you're a regular listener and you can sort of pad their pockets a little bit more and you don't have to endure the ads. But I it really comes down to those individual streams. That's supposedly where the artists are benefiting. And, you know, the other thing that needs to be pointed out here is that you're still talking about a middleman who's feeding money to another middleman who then in turn may or may not give the artist their fair share. We're assuming that Sound Exchange pays the artist exactly what they're owed when they get a royalty fee from the internet provider. But you don't know, and it's a similar system to the way the record industry used to work. You know, the money would get funneled to the record company, which in turn would pay the artist, but you never knew. I mean, all the accountants were on the record industry side, so the artists really didn't know if they were getting paid fairly or not unless they could afford an attorney to go and dig into those records. So
they knew they weren't being paid fairly. They knew.
Yeah. So artists are basically at the whim of, these middlemen in terms of being able to determine whether or not they're being paid fairly. So I find that scenario a little troubling about this new industry that we're looking at. We're basically still looking at middlemen funneling money to the artists, and whether or not the artists are getting paid at a fair rate, the artists really don't know because they're at the bottom of the food chain again.
We have an email from Aisha. She says, I'm a music listener and a producer. Most of my time is spent on SoundCloud and Beatport. And I make my music with sample drum machines and computers. And all the income comes from clubs, gigs, I guess, in clubs. So she's asking, what's the current state of sampling legally, where artists like Girl Talk use content for free, but others pay heavy royalties? Who'd like to take that on? Brian?
Not me.
Not you.
I can't actually speak to the Girl Talk issue. I mean, okay. This has been a huge... I wrote about him rather extensively in the book I wrote a few years ago, Ripped. And, it is so blatant what Girl Talk is doing. And, I mean, he's intentionally taking on the whole fair use issue here in attacking copyright law as presently written. Basically saying, you know, if I take this 30-second sample of this Madonna song... You know, I owe her, you know, tons and tons of money. Let's not even say 30 seconds. Usually, Girl Talk operates in increments of about 10 or 15 seconds. And you know, I would owe her a lot of money, or her publisher a lot of money because I'm using this little sound sample. And he was basically challenging that whole notion that, you know, this is an art form here. I'm recontextualizing this, reconfiguring these bits of pre-recorded music. And turning them into something new, and it was in some ways a dare to the music industry and copyright law, saying, you know, if you want to take this on, let's go, because I believe what we have here is a new art form, and the law really isn't keeping up with way music creation is going. And if you listen to any Girl Talk album, there is truly artistry going on there. So the point being. You know, he wanted to take this on, but nobody came at him because everybody sort of agreed, you know, at least the people that I've talked to in the music industry who could potentially be suing this guy are saying, you know what, it's actually kind of an honor to be sampled by Girl Talk and to have a bit of our music in his pastiche that he's creating, and it's kind of cool. Mm. And you'd look like an idiot for suing this guy. You would look like a curmudgeon. You would look like Metallica looked 10 years ago when they went after Napster. It was the same kind of thing. Metallica never really fully recovered from bludgeoning Napster 10 years ago. Mm. In the same way, they're also now afraid to go after Girl Talk because they're thinking, you know, we would look very uncool going after this guy. So it makes me think that the laws are sort of being bent a little bit, and we're going to probably see more of it rather than less of it in the future, and maybe at some point the copyright law may actually catch up with it.
We're continuing to get emails. Jeff from Palo Alto said, I'd love to go to more live shows, but just won't go to big shows anymore. They're way too expensive, and smaller shows are all in urban centers. What we need is a zillion more venues and a wide variety of vibe, i.e. not just nightlife style, more small, spontaneous shows in the suburbs, basically.
I would love to talk about that
one.
Yeah,
Zoe, go ahead.
Very quickly, is that there's a big missing hole between the music companies and the artists, in that, going back to Pandora, again, I have 1.5 million listens like this year, and where are those people? I would love to find them. And I think that there's some really interesting things happening in the music tech space of crowdsourcing shows.
Mm-hmm.
And I would really love to see some of the larger companies like Spotify and even Pandora, what have you, get in on the maybe helping artists crowdsource a tour from the listener database to go to these places where their listeners might be, but I don't know that they're there, and my agent won't book me there because, you know, he's like, well, how do you know you have listeners there? So
right.
I think that there's a lot that could happen for artists to pad out their tours with, you know, they'll play in the big city, but then maybe through crowdsourcing they can play a show in the suburb.
Crowdsourcing concerts, that
yeah.
Seems like the future. That'll be your final thought today, Zoe. Let's go to Brian. We only have a couple of minutes left. Mm-hmm. Final thoughts from you. Where are we going? Where's this going?
It's all about the artists and their fans connecting more directly, as Zoe says, and as these house concerts in the rural areas, and even with vinyl, where you go and buy a fetish item directly from the artist. I think less money will be spent on music, but more money will go to the artists, and the middlemen will get less. The big thing is artists no longer need to sign their rights away to get compensated, and that's a good thing.
Okay, Greg, what about you? Some final thoughts on this issue.
Yeah, I essentially agree. I'm actually very optimistic about the future for artists. I think there's a bright future out there. It's a way better scenario for them than it was 10, 12 years ago. I do think that every artist will become their own record company. And I think they will have, they still need the support of a record company, quote unquote, but it'll be a much smaller unit. It'll be four or five or six people supporting that artist and creating a real base for them to create a true middle class, existence that will enable them to continue making art as a living, as opposed to, a hobby or something that they do on the side.
All right, wonderful. Well, I'd like to thank all of you for joining us today. Greg Kot, music critic at the Chicago Tribune for over 20 years. You hear him on Sound Opinions on NPR. Zoe Keating, critically acclaimed musician. Lots of fans here in the Bay Area, including many callers today. Thank you for joining us. Brian Zisk produces the San Francisco Music Tech Summit, and he wants you to know the next one is coming up February 19th, 2013. Thank you to all the callers and the emailers who let us know how they consume music today. And I'm Hanat Baba, and this is what's happening tomorrow on the show. What kind of bill do you think would create a more just economy and society? And who can make it happen? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the renewed calls for immigration reform. Both Republicans and Democrats talk about a path to citizenship. What does a comprehensive immigration policy look like? Join us live at 10 or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. What's possible for immigration reform now? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.